Now, Larry, you are running for the U.S. Senate against the sitting Congress member Andy Kim and the labor activist Patricia Campos Medina. Mm-hmm. You and Campos Medina have called for a ceasefire, but you're the only one who is endorsing an uncommitted vote when it comes to the presidential line on the New Jersey Democratic primary ticket.
That is absolutely correct.
But before we go to that, I want to ask you about what happened at Princeton and go back in time.
Yes.
These students that are protesting and have set up the encampment are calling from Princeton to divest from Israel. Can you talk about the precedent in the 1970s? You graduated in 78. Talk about what you did then.
Well, we started a four-year campaign in 1974 to get Princeton to divest from companies that were doing business with the racist apartheid regime. For the first 3 years, we protested, we did educational activities. Then in the fourth year, 1978, we intensified our activity, and we had 66 days of consecutive protests at Nassau Hall that culminated in a takeover of Nassau Hall on April 14th, 1978, 210 of us went into Nassau Hall. As a result of that sit-in, the university agreed to divest from, I believe, three companies that were doing business with South Africa. During that entire period, I'm talking about from 1974 through 78, outside police were never called in to the university. They weren't even called in when we had the sit-in. So I was appalled and outraged when I heard that police had been called onto campus to arrest graduate and undergraduate students for participating in this current movement for divestment from Israel.
And how did it work then? Were you negotiating with the administration in the 1970s? You were the leader of this movement.
Well, I have to say, in all truth, that there was a lot of recalcitrance. For several years, the president of the university at that time, President Bowen, wouldn't meet with us. It wasn't until 1978 when they saw that the majority of the campus was and the faculty were in support of divestment, would they even listen to us? And it wasn't until we had the sit-in that they actually agreed to meet our key demand, which was for divestment. And then they only did so partially. And I have to say that the movement continued after 1978 with new student leaders. In fact, the following year, there was a sit-in at Firestone University.
Where is Firestone?
Firestone University is the major library on Princeton's campus. So I'm trying to make the point that the struggle against apartheid continued for many years, even after 1978. But I have to say I'm really proud of the students that have been protesting and the students that are on hunger strike. I wrote a letter 2 days ago to President Eisgruber, condemning the bringing outside police onto the campus, condemning the arrests of the students, supporting their demands, and also calling for total amnesty for all the students and any faculty that might be involved.
And Eisgruber, did he respond?
He has not responded yet, no.
So talk about the position you're taking. This is pretty unusual for a Democratic Party senatorial candidate. Mm-hmm. Well, in your case, in June, in the primary, again, you're running against Andy Kim, the Congress member, and Patricia Campos Medina. You and Campos Medina have called for a ceasefire. But you're calling for an uncommitted vote when it comes to the president.
Absolutely. First of all, I'm totally opposed to the Biden administration's approach to this genocidal war in Gaza. There must be an immediate and permanent ceasefire, and the United States should cease any military aid to Israel. Why am I urging people to vote uncommitted for president. In the Democratic primary, people will be able to vote for president, U.S. Senate, and other offices. For president, there are two candidates, of course, Joe Biden, someone else, but there's a third choice, and that choice is uncommitted. I'm going to vote uncommitted. I urge other people to vote uncommitted because I think that is a strong way to, that is a way to send a strong message to the Biden administration that we are totally dissatisfied with his approach, that we want the war to end, that we want a ceasefire, and we want an end to genocide in Gaza. So that's why I'm going to vote uncommitted, and I'm urging others to.
Senator, today, what would you be doing?
Well, I'd be voting against any aid, any more aid, as Andy Kim did. Andy Kim voted for, he says he's for ceasefire, but then he voted for $26 billion more to go to this genocidal war in Gaza. So I would be voting against any further military aid to Israel until this war comes to an end, and until the occupation comes to an end.
And your assessment of Bob Menendez, the U.S. senator whose seat you are running for, Bob Menendez, who's been charged multiple corruption charges, though has not yet been tried, is about to be.
Right. Well, I think Menendez, he's indicted himself. His behavior has led to, this is the second time that he's been indicted. He was indicted and tried in 2018, and now this is happening again. He's indicted on corruption charges and possibly being an agent of a foreign government. But the other point is that he and Senator Cory Booker have both supported this genocidal war in Gaza. They have both voted for hundreds of billions of dollars of military aid, which has resulted in more than 35,000 people being killed, 15,000 of those being children and women, and 19,000 orphans, 1 million people displaced, and on, and mass starvation being used as a weapon. So Menendez saw the handwriting on the wall, so he's not running for re-election.
Finally, just going back to the approach to these protest encampments around the country, when you took over Nassau Hall, like Columbia, mm-hmm. the takeover of Hamilton Hall, which also mm-hmm. happened in the 60s around the Vietnam War, mm-hmm. there were no arrests. The police didn't move in, and you got a number of your demands met.
That's right. That is correct. Now, I don't want to give a misimpression. There were protests on college campuses for divestment from South Africa across the country. And there were situations on other campuses when the police were called in. It did not happen at Princeton University for a whole host of reasons.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Larry Hamm, chair of the People's Organization for Progress. His new book is titled Lawrence Hamm, A Life in the Struggle. He's running for the U.S. Senate from New Jersey, the primary in June. When we come back, a new play recalls a devastating fire at London's Grenfell Tower. It's written by Gillian Slovo, the daughter of legendary South African anti-apartheid activists Joe Slovo and Ruth First. She was killed when South African police sent her a letter bomb. We're going to talk to her about the two divestment movements and then about the play. Stay with us.
Don't take it from no poor man. Mama ain't free from no rich man, no how. Never take from the mouth of another child, take it from the heaviest bough. See me coming up that hill, you see me coming now, bringing something good for my baby. I swear you keep me true to my
Life by Cynthia Erivo. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Gaza solidarity encampments on college campuses that have now spread worldwide are calling for schools to divest from companies profiting from Israeli apartheid and settler colonialism in much the same way a global movement by student activists in the 80s and the 70s called for their universities to divest from companies that profited from apartheid South Africa. This week, I spoke about both divestment movements with South African-born novelist and playwright Gillian Slovo. Her parents were the legendary South African anti-apartheid activists. Her father, Joe Slovo, a leader of the South African Communist Party and the African National Congress, went back to South Africa and served in President Nelson Mandela's cabinet as Minister of Housing. Her mother, Ruth First, tragically assassinated in Mozambique when South African police sent her a letter bomb. I asked Gillian Slovo her thoughts on the Gaza encampments today and comparing them to what happened in the anti-apartheid movement of the 70s and 80s.
I just think what the students are doing is absolutely wonderful to draw to the world's attention and to the authorities' attention that we don't have to tolerate what we're seeing without actually saying something should be done about it. And I've never been to Gaza, but I have been to the West Bank, and I had a childhood in South Africa. I knew what apartheid looked like. And I can tell you, when I went to the West Bank, what I saw was apartheid in action, in the fact that people have different rights and different right to be on the land that is theirs. And during the 80s, I was part of the anti-apartheid movement and part of the call for disinvestment and sanctions and boycott. And I think it was one peaceful way of trying to reverse what was happening in South Africa. It certainly made white South Africans think, why is the world doing this to us? And to examine what was happening. And in a situation like South Africa was, and like I think Israel is now, where the news is filtered so badly for the people there, where they only see what their government wants them to see, I think that made a difference to how people were in South Africa, and I think it will make a difference to how people are in Israel.
And you're not only South African-born, your parents leading anti-apartheid activists. You're also Jewish. And I'm wondering if you can comment on those who equate anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's no equation between anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism, but I think anti-Semitism is being weaponized by people to try and drown out voices of people, Jewish and non-Jewish, who are saying that we should not be having what is happening, what we can see happening on our screens, despite much of the killing of journalists in order to prevent it being on our screens, that we should stand together to call out against our governments who are arming this barbarity that we are seeing happen, unfold in front of us.
And the whole issue of using divestment as a way to put pressure on a government, how effective you think that global movement was when it came to South Africa?
It definitely had impact. It had impact economically on South Africa, perhaps not as much as we wanted it to, but it certainly did have an impact. And it had impact on the government, the then government, in facing the fact that if this continued and if they continued in the way that they were, they might not be any longer economically viable. And the thing about those campaigns is they are a peaceful attempt to change the situation.
And the media, how important it is in covering these voices?
Absolutely crucial. And I think there has been a move in all our countries, and certainly by Israel, to stop the media from covering this in a fair way, to use the accusation of anti-Semitism to silence critics of what is happening. And what I think is so amazing about the students who are camping out and protesting against what is happening and calling for divestment is they don't seem to feel guilt-tripped by this. They are Jews, they are Muslims, they are Christians, and they're all together in a conviction that we should not be seeing what is happening, we should not be allowing what is happening to happen, and that we need to put pressure on our governments to stop it.
That was South African-born novelist and playwright Gillian Slovo, whose parents, Joe Slovo and Ruth First, were the legendary South African anti-apartheid activists, her mother assassinated by the South African police. She was speaking to us from London. I also spoke to Gillian Slovo this week about her new play, which runs through Sunday in Brooklyn, New York, at St. Anne's Warehouse. It recalls how in 2017, a devastating apartment fire in London's Grenfell Tower killed 72 residents. It was the worst fire in Britain since World War II. Survivors marched to the British Parliament to protest the government's handling of the disaster. The story of the residents from the Caribbean, Portugal, Syria, Morocco, Ethiopia, Britain, and how they created a thriving community as their public housing fell into disrepair from mismanagement in the years before the fire is told in the play Grenfell, in the words of survivors. It draws on interviews with residents at the heart of the fire, has been called a riveting call to action to finish the investigation into the catastrophe. This is the trailer.
It was a normal day and a normal evening. I wasn't feeling well because I was pregnant.
We were about to celebrate our 27th wedding. My wife and I, on the 15th of June, we decided to invite some of our friends from the building.
It was a nice, warm evening, I remember. Around 9, 10 o'clock, I went to bed.
Fire brigade.
Hello, hi, is it fire? It's 516
Gunfeld Road. Sorry, a fire where?
I'm lying in bed. I heard my neighbour smoke alarm going, bah, bah, bah. I didn't even bother getting out of bed.
Between 1:20 and 2-ish, all hell broke loose.
So I started screaming, where's my wife? Where is my wife?
Kids were literally trying to push the door shut.
The combustibility in H1, you save costs.
Absolute building system fail.
1, 2, 3, 4.
One of the key aims of this coalition is to massively reduce rules, laws, regulations.
To predict something is going to happen and have it happen and not be able to stop it. There's no words for that.
The trailer for the play Grenfell, in the words of survivors, comes as the Grenfell Tower Inquiry's final report into the disaster has been delayed for the third time. That last voice was the words of Ed Daffarn, a survivor of the Grenfell Tower fire, who's portrayed in the play. Also, Gillian Slovo, the South African-born novelist and playwright behind the play. I began by asking Gillian what prompted her to take on the topic.
Because I, like many people in Britain and possibly all over the world, watched in absolute horror as that building burned and asked myself the question, how is it possible that this can happen in this capital city of one of the richest countries in the world, in certainly one of the richest boroughs in that city as well? And I realized that the only way that one could talk about this in the theater was by using the real people's words. They had or had their words taken away from them. They had people speaking for them, and their voices were so powerful that I began to investigate whether people would be prepared to talk to me for the play, and actually Ed was one of the first people I met who I asked if he would talk to us.
And Ed, talk about what you were doing at the time of the fire, how you became aware of it.
So, Amy, it was a beautiful, beautiful, warm, hot day in London. We're in the middle of Ramadan. People were enjoying, enjoying just a normal, everyday existence. And then that evening I went to bed. I went to bed about 12:30, 1 o'clock. And a few minutes later, I heard my neighbor's smoke alarm going off, a kind of ping, ping, ping sound. And to be honest with you, I was so unconcerned that I didn't even get out of bed. I just assumed that my neighbour had burnt something in the kitchen and set his smoke alarm off. But a couple of minutes later, there was a kind of some commotion out in the communal hallway. And at like 1:15 at night, that was very unusual. So I hopped out of bed, put on a pair of shorts, went to my front door, opened my front door, expecting to see my neighbour there, you know, apologising for burning something in his kitchen. But instead of that happening, as I opened my front door, I was confronted by this wave of black smoke. And my heart just dropped. I just couldn't believe it. This wasn't a minor incident. This was like something obviously very serious. And my first instinct was to stay where I was because our landlord had instructed us to stay put in the building if there was a fire. But literally 2 seconds later, my phone rang and it was a neighbour of mine from downstairs who'd already exited the building. And he shouted at me. He said to me, "Get out. Get out of the building." And he said it in such a forceful way, so powerfully, that I didn't argue with him. So I went to my bathroom, I wetted a towel, I put a towel around my mouth, and then I exited out into the communal hallway, needing to find the emergency stairwell, which was about 5 metres diagonally, but it was so smoky that I couldn't see beyond the end of my nose. And in attempting to find my way to the emergency exit, I actually hit the wall to the left-hand side of the door. And instead of figuring out I needed to move, I started panicking and I let go of my towel and then I started inhaling the smoke. And then I was literally thinking to myself, I'm not going to get out of this. I'm going to, you know, this is it. When at that moment, a firefighter who'd come through the door, which I was very close to, tapped me on my leg and got up and then grabbed hold of me. And then him and his fellow firefighter dragged me out into the communal hallway. And then I just ran for, after getting myself together, I just ran for my life downstairs. So I'm here. It's like a million to one chance, really.
I want to go to a clip right now of another of the residents, Rabia Yahya. She is played by Hoda Echuafni in the play Grenfell, in the words of the survivors.
So then my neighbour, she the mum, she said, OK, we'll go together. So she tried to get some towels to wet for her boys and I went to help her to wet them. But there was no water pressure. It was literally dripping. And we had to wait ages just to wet the towels. We wet them, and then we pushed the door open. And I picked up my little one, picked her up on my chest. She was free at the time. And I remember holding on to my kids' both hands. And she was called Monkey, because she was always like a little monkey. She just clings on. She clung on to me. You couldn't see nothing. It was pitch black.
And then there's Maher Kader, who's played by Ghaz Chowdhury. He was a Syrian refugee, had come to Britain, had his family there in Glenfell. He used crutches. 40% of those who died in the fire were disabled. He talks about what happened.
My eldest daughter knocked on our bedroom door. She knocked. She said, "Dad, there's a fire." She said they were going to go downstairs. I said, "No, wait here." I opened the front door and realized there was smoke coming up, black. I closed the door and said, "Clearly there's something going on, a fire in a room or a flat, just stay here." My eldest said, "No, we need to go downstairs." My youngest said, "Touch the wall, Dad, it's like fire." The wall next to their bed in the living room. I said, "You go downstairs, all of you." My wife refused, saying that with my condition, I needed help. I said, "No, the kids are here. Go downstairs because you'll get down fast, but I'm slow. Go. If they lose me, at least they'll have you." I made my wife and daughters leave first because I move slowly.
Julian Slovo, one of the horrors in this play that's repeated over and over by the different survivors was the stay put order and how seriously people were taken when they called the authorities, right, the equivalent of 911 in the United States, those that had accents, for example, and what they were told. Can you tell us some of those stories of the people that you profile, that you animate their words?
I mean, the problem was in Grenfell, because of the cladding, the fire went up that building within 20 minutes. It went up right to the top of that building. But the people who answered the 911, what we call 999 calls, were in a separate office. They had no access to seeing the pictures of where the fire had gone. And as a result, when people rung up and said, there's smoke in my building, there's fire outside my window, it's coming into my neighbors, they were told, no, it's on the fourth floor, don't worry, stay put. Because that was the orthodoxy, that buildings were supposed to be built in a way that if a fire not on your floor and not near your floor, you should be safe enough to stay inside. I think what is amazing about listening to some of the evidence that was given is that the firefighters were, in a way, blinkered. They saw what was happening from outside, but they didn't really know what to do, whereas people from the area who were watching were shouting, get out. That's one of the reasons that Ed got out. He didn't phone 911. He actually was phoned by a friend who told him in the right voice, get out of that building. There were, however, people who did phone 911 and were told, stay put, we will come and get you, and were disbelieved. And there is some evidence from the calls that the better you spoke English, the more that the operators would listen to what you were saying, that if your English was in any way faulty or you had an accent, they just wouldn't believe what you were saying. In fact, those people in the flats were right, and what the firefighters were saying was wrong.
So where are the survivors today, and where is the inquiry today?
So, I mean, I think most of the survivors, I can't speak for everyone, have been rehomed. The focus now very much has, you know, basically in the immediate aftermath of the fire, we really just needed like a very humanitarian response. We just needed to kind of come together, have some time, have some space, come to terms with that sort of trauma. And then I think the following year, we were much more focused on the practicalities about kind of where people were living, you know, how people's mental health issues were going to be addressed. And as time's moved on, the focus now is much more around three things: truth, justice and change. And truth will hopefully come out finally when the public inquiry report is published, although we don't have a date for that. Justice is very difficult. There has still not been a single arrest for the perpetrators of the fire at Grenfell Tower that killed 72 people. But as survivors and bereaved, we are determined that we don't want people to be treated the same way that we are. So we campaign for changes to the law around people who live in about the way that people who live in social housing are treated. It's very frustrating. It's very frustrating that almost 7 years after Grenfell, some of the recommendations that were made in the first phase of the public inquiry have still not been enacted by the government. And, you know, we're coming up now to the phase two and those recommendations. But there's a, you know, there's a mistrust of government in that if they can't implement phase one recommendations, what faith will we have that they'll be able to implement phase two recommendations?
Ed Daffarn, survivor who's portrayed in the play Grenfell in the words of survivors, and playwright Gillian Slovo, South African born. The play runs through Sunday, May 12th at St. Anne's Warehouse in Brooklyn, New York. It's performed by London's National Theatre. And this interesting fact, today is the 30th anniversary of the inauguration of South African President Nelson Mandela. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Do you like dramatic beginnings? Doom, 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 doom. This is Charlotte Farrell, your own Sister C, here at the place to be, CJSF Radio 90.1, and streaming worldwide at cjsf.ca. On behalf of everyone here at CJSF, I want to thank you. We appreciate your tuning in to 90.1 FM on the dial, choosing your time tuned in to CJSF 90.1 FM. Shows you value the hard work of our hosts and programmers. You find that time worthwhile, and we value your commitment. Thank you for being here. You're the best part of CJSF.